Hello. As I said earlier in this series, I tell my students at Bowdoin College up in Maine that nobody ever escapes my classes without hearing about the Lake Chad Basin and the Northern Mandara Mountains of Central Africa. And so now you've heard about them. In my last talk, I spoke about archaeological research in the southern basin of Lake Chad and recent work on developments that indicate that population densities and social cultural systems were much more complex in the past in this region, and complex from earlier periods than archaeologists had previously realized. I noted that progress in these areas has been relatively rapid, particularly over the last 10 years, and in part this is associated with technological advances like magnetometry, which allow us to, in some cases, begin to assemble pictures of the buried extent, the buried characteristics of ancient archaeological sites before excavation takes place. And this allows us to plan our archaeological excavations, which are very, very time-intensive. They're a lot of work. We can plan them more intelligently. This sort of technological advance will continue. And we can imagine how this changes the potentials for evaluating ancient sites, especially if, as I've said, archaeologists want to get away from preoccupations with capitals and pyramids and monumental architecture, which are generally pretty easy to find if we want to begin to get some idea about how the other 99.9% of the population actually lived. So I want to turn now to the last area that we're going to consider in sub-Saharan Africa. We're moving to southeastern Africa and to the site of Great Zimbabwe. Great Zimbabwe, high on the Zimbabwe plateau, astonished the first Europeans who saw it in the middle of the 19th century with its extraordinary walls and enclosures built with a very careful, very sophisticated dry stone architecture. Karl Malk, a German trader, was the first European to extensively describe Great Zimbabwe after he was shown it by local people in 1871. As I said, when we speak about the discovery of these sites, they may be discoveries to European science, to Western science, but these are places that are known by people who live there from ancient times. Great Zimbabwe was probably visited by Portuguese traders in the 16th century after it had been abandoned, and quite possibly by Arab or Yemeni merchants when it was a flourishing urban center, a real city, some centuries before that. Unfortunately, if descriptions of Great Zimbabwe existed from that period, they do not appear to have survived until the present day. The history of Great Zimbabwe as an archaeological site has been extraordinarily complicated. And it's safe to say that few archaeological sites, few such sites in the world, have been subjected to the degree of abuse and distortion and misrepresentation sustained by Great Zimbabwe. Safe to say that few have been as important in regional politics. Great Zimbabwe is, after all, the only archaeological site in the world to have a country named after it. And there must be some significances in that. I want to talk for a few minutes then, just very briefly, about the past, the history of Great Zimbabwe as an archaeological site, because this is a significant history right from the initial pronouncements on the site, the initial writings on the site by Karl Malk. And what I will note is that this is not merely involved misrepresentation of the site in the scientific and popular literature, but actually damage to the site as well. Blinded by racist assumptions. European colonialists and scientists and settlers of the 19th century could not believe that this large, sophisticated, beautiful archaeological site, this complex architecture, had been built by Africans. And so they concocted fanciful stories about the Queen of Sheba having built it, about wandering Phoenicians, about the lost tribes of Israel, about almost anyone except southern African populations. In a search for gold, much of the area of the site, known as the Hill Ruin, was stripped of archaeological deposits by Europeans who called themselves archaeologists at the beginning of the 20th century, down to a depth of 2 to 3 meters or 6 to 10 feet. The materials were simply stripped away in a gold mining expedition by entirely misguided and greedy individuals pretending to be archaeologists. And the remains, the archaeological remains through this area, were simply discarded. I can't overestimate the amount of damage and wanton destruction that this involved, and the way in which this damage limits our interpretations of the archaeological site of Great Zimbabwe. Such fictions about the foreign origins of the site have persisted until far too recently. Indeed, they persist today. Long after professional archaeologists had established that Great Zimbabwe was an indigenous African urban center, the capital of a large territorial state, the white government and white settlers in what was then Rhodesia denied that possibility and forbid archaeologists working in the country to speak of it or write of it. During this period, at least one archaeologist was forced to leave Rhodesia because of attacks on his work. And as I said, fringe theorists, they still exist, still unwilling to allow the possibility of African cultural inspiration, African cultural events. Fringe theorists continue to make up stories about the site today. In turn, the site became an important icon in the African struggle against white rule as well, and subsequently in independent Zimbabwe. So the question remains for us then, for archaeologists, what really are the origins of Great Zimbabwe? From the point of view of this series of lectures, it's a very germane issue. We have the appearance of a complex territorial state in southern Africa. How do we understand its origins? How do we understand its development? What processes brought it into being? The story begins at approximately AD 200 to 400. Over this period of a couple of centuries, there was a very rapid dispersal of iron-using farming communities from eastern Africa, where they'd already existed for centuries, down south through Mozambique and Zimbabwe into what is now South Africa. Before that time, foraging populations, hunters and gatherers, had occupied the area around Great Zimbabwe. This initial spread of farmers was probably along the Indian Ocean coast of eastern and southeastern Africa. Populations of agriculturalists moving down the coast. But occupation inland began very quickly thereafter. So it appears that these farming groups first moved out along the Indian Ocean coast, and once they'd reached the area of what's now South Africa, then movement inland commenced. These farmers who then moved inland and occupied areas like the Zimbabwe Plateau, cultivated African cereal crops, crops that we've already encountered in previous lectures when I've talked about African prehistory, sorghum and millet particularly. They kept cattle, sheep, and goats. Cattle in particular would have thrived on the Zimbabwe Plateau, away from the coastal lowlands. Those coastal lowlands harbored diseases like trypanosomiasis, spread by the tsetse fly. This is a parasite closely related to that which produces sleeping sickness in humans, and it can very quickly sicken and kill animals like cattle and horses. Indeed, the existence of trypanosomiasis was probably one of the chief factors that blocked southern expansion of pastoralists in Central and West Africa in the early mid-Holocene. One factor that restricted them to the areas that are now the southern part of the Sahara was probably the existence of trypanosomiasis spread by the tsetse fly in wetter areas further to the south. So the moving inland, we move back to southeastern Africa. After this initial spread of farmers along the coast, moving inland would have allowed the expansion of cattle herds, particularly. Over the period between AD 500 and AD 900, control over and expansion of these cattle herds seems to have developed as a central form of wealth in these African farming communities, a way of conceiving of resources and relationships between people. Because, as I'll note in a minute, cattle become far more than simply a meat resource, a milk resource in these communities. These inland village sites, as farmers move away from the coast and spread onto, for example, the Zimbabwe Plateau, these inland village sites are often much larger than their coastal contemporaries. And they give a distinct impression of an expanding and dynamic population. These processes culminate in the development of a new cultural tradition in this part of southeastern Africa at about AD 1000. That's called the Leopard's Copy tradition, named after one of the first sites excavated. The Leopard's Copy tradition is, in general terms, descended from these early farming communities of the first millennium AD, but with some changes in ceramic styles and with evidence of even larger herds of cattle. This process is certainly happening on the Zimbabwe Plateau, around the Zimbabwe Plateau, and also in areas like the Limpopo Valley to the south, close to the border with South Africa, at sites like Bambangyanalo. So there are three important developments in this region of southeastern Africa at about AD 1000. The context of these developments then is this expanding, dynamic agricultural tradition with an extensive economic and ideological investment in cattle herding. So what are these developments? Well, first, we see through this period convincing evidence for an expansion of regional trading networks extending from the eastern Kalahari Desert in what's now Botswana to the Indian Ocean coast of Mozambique and eventually north to what's now Zambia. At the same time, leparoscopic communities were engaged in gold mining activities, as demonstrated by the discovery of pottery from this tradition in abandoned Zimbabwean gold workings. And third, glass trade beads, originally made in South Asia, in India or Pakistan primarily, began to appear on southeastern African sites. I will note the importance of these trade beads in trading systems throughout many areas of Africa in prehistoric times, And also note their usefulness to archaeologists, because like obsidian and like some other materials that I've talked about in earlier lectures, these glass trade beads can be sourced. We can examine the chemical composition of the glass and in many cases trace them to particular points of manufacture in different parts of the old world, which again allows us to begin tracing the extent and characteristics of trading networks. So these different developments, regional trading networks, gold working, the appearance of glass trade beads on sites, these events are probably related. This region of southeastern Africa was being tied together by connections of trade and exchange. And these networks articulated with Indian Ocean trading routes, possibly controlled by Arab or Yemeni or Swahili traders, the latter groups of people living along the East African coast in what's now Kenya and Tanzania. This was a truly international trading network. This also had important implications for social systems around the Zimbabwe plateau. Because when you think of cattle, you think of cattle as a locus, a nexus of ideological value in these societies. And as I said, they do play that role in many societies in different parts of the world. Cattle become more than simply meat on the hoof, more than simply sources of milk. They become a currency in social relations. One marries. One compensates for crimes. One retains relationships with the ancestors through cattle, through the exchange of cattle, through the sacrifice of cattle. But the primary characteristic of cattle as a source of wealth is that they are a somewhat democratic source of wealth in these societies. And they are a democratic source of wealth because cattle reproduce. They reproduce. You can increase your wealth in cattle, if you're a careful husbandman, without outside intervention. You can become more wealthy by increasing the size of your cattle herds. And you can do so anywhere that grazing can be found. As I said, a democratic form of wealth, a form of wealth that allows people who are hardworking and smart and lucky to potentially at least think of the possibility of becoming well off, becoming rich, entirely under their own efforts, through their own efforts. On the other hand, gold and exotic goods like trade beads, those are not democratic forms of wealth. These kinds of goods can be much more easily controlled by an elite group. Glass, trade beads, gold. Unlike cattle, neither of these things reproduce. And the restricted areas in which they originate, mines, trading ports and emporia, trade routes, they tend to be easier to control than grasslands on which cattle can be grazed. So, perhaps new kinds of wealth originating in this area, new kinds of wealth appearing, and less democratic kinds of wealth, sorts of wealth more amenable to hierarchy. In the 10th and 11th centuries AD, elites developed in a number of areas in southeastern Africa, with the base of their power both traditional ritual and social control over cattle, and as well control over these high-value trade goods and over the indigenous products, especially gold and probably ivory, that could be used to obtain those trade goods. This process can be seen at Limpopo Valley sites like Tutswe Mogala in eastern Botswana and Bambanyanalo in the Limpopo Valley, where elite occupation in the early 13th century AD was transferred to a nearby hilltop called Mapungubwe and was both transferred and transformed. So here we have a developing elite, increasingly in control of gold and trade goods, and now doing something quite different, moving away from the centers of their communities to areas where they can overlook the settlements of common people, moving up onto hills at places like Mapungubwe, where they can look down over the houses and households of commoners. And this idea of elites overlooking common people would continue in Great Zimbabwe as well. Stone walls and valuable materials like gold, copper, and imported glass beads set members of the Mapungubwe elite well off, well away from common people. All of these elements, elite housing in elevated areas, stone walling, valuable goods, valuable materials, were at the same time appearing to the north at this site, Great Zimbabwe, during the same period. So the same development of elite control appearing at the same time at Great Zimbabwe. Originally, Mapungubwe and Great Zimbabwe may have been more or less equal political units, but Mapungubwe declined at the end of the 13th century AD, possibly because of climate changes, while Great Zimbabwe went from strength to strength. A century after the abandonment of Mapungubwe, Great Zimbabwe was a complex of stone enclosures, walls, platforms, and habitation areas, extending over an area of more than 1,800 acres around a hill, which again allowed members of the Great Zimbabwe elite to overlook the habitations of common people and into an adjacent valley as well. At its height, in the 14th and 15th centuries AD, the population of Great Zimbabwe was probably between 15 and 18,000 people, consisting of elite groups living in buildings within the stone enclosures on the hilltop and in the valley, and a much larger population of common people inhabiting wattle and daub structures made of earth and organic material around the elite core, surrounding the elite core. And this was a true urban center of the period, the first in southern Africa. Great Zimbabwe elites, the rulers of Great Zimbabwe, the nobility of Great Zimbabwe, monopolized access to gold, to copper, and to those items traded in from the Indian Ocean coast. The copper possibly coming from what's now Zambia. These members of the elite, as far as we can determine, from what remains around the edges of the hill enclosure, this area plundered by archaeologists at the beginning of the 20th century, also had preferential access to the meat of young cattle. Unfortunately, and in part because of that plundering, we know relatively little about the structure or the ideology of this elite group. Debates about these issues have tended to center on the extent to which we can understand government at Great Zimbabwe by analogy to historically known leadership in communities in southern Africa some centuries later. And this often has to do with details of the interpretation of particular elements in the stone architecture of the site. As I noted, because of the clearing of the hilltop ruin, there's very little to excavate in much of that area. But we still do have the stone architecture, the extraordinary stone architecture that made the site so striking for those Europeans who first saw it. So we depend, as we do in many other cases as well, on ethnographic analogy, on analogies to historically known populations, if we're trying to interpret the way that rule functioned not Great Zimbabwe. And this tends to be quite a controversial topic. Thus, for example, Tom Huffman, an archaeologist who worked on the site and around the site for decades, interpreted the layout of elite stone construction on the site as representing a complex ritual system where the hilltop structures were primarily associated with the male king, and the large stone structures in the valley below, including the remarkable complex known as the Great Enclosure, were primarily associated with women, both in the first place royal wives, and in the second place the daughters of noble lineages who would undergo initiation into adulthood in buildings within these complexes of stone walling. And the political implications of initiation into adulthood and marriage for these young women of noble lineages would be quite significant. These interpretations draw from ethnographic parallels taken from populations, groups called Venda people, in what's now South Africa, hundreds of miles away and hundreds of years later. This raises the question of the kinds of analogies that archaeologists should be drawing upon in order to interpret ancient prehistoric sites and ancient societies. As I noted, much of the fine domestic detail on elite life was lost when the site was plundered by Europeans searching for gold at the beginning of the 20th century. There is, for example, a set of extraordinary soapstone bird carvings, which are now one of the symbols of the country of Zimbabwe, that were recovered, dispersed to different parts of the world, and have only recently been gathered back to Zimbabwe. In any case, Great Zimbabwe seems to have been the capital of a substantial territorial state, one probably approaching the size of the modern state of Zimbabwe, with trading relations extending from the Indian Ocean coast of Mozambique into the African interior. Smaller stone analogs to Great Zimbabwe, probably the communities of subsidiary leaders acting as elements in a territorial hierarchy, an administrative hierarchy over the state, are found across the Zimbabwe plateau. The Great Zimbabwe site was abandoned by the early 16th century AD, and the territorial coherence of the state it controlled was lost, it broke up. A number of factors may have contributed to the decline of the Great Zimbabwe site. For example, environmental degradation associated with the large urban population and manifested through overgrazing and erosion, a loss of soil fertility, and a decline in the number of trees available for fuel. There also seems to be a decline in the trading system at this point, associated with both the exhaustion of gold sources easily available to the Great Zimbabwe elite and disruption of the trade routes linking the site to the Indian Ocean trade. Great Zimbabwe was succeeded by a number of smaller states, including the Mutapa state and the state of Torwa or Kami. And these, in some cases, were known to European and especially Portuguese traders in later times. These continued to be involved to lesser degrees in Indian Ocean trading systems, albeit primarily through the export of goods like ivory and later slaves rather than gold. As in the other areas of Africa that we've examined, state formation at Great Zimbabwe seems to have been associated with a number of economic and cultural changes involving agricultural intensification, population growth, and the establishment of both regional and intercontinental trading links. In these circumstances, well-positioned individuals, families, and lineages could tap into new forms of wealth and so vastly increase their influence and power. This set of processes was probably also at work in other areas of the world, many other parts of the world, from Uruk to Knossos, to Harappa, to Yinshu, to Ok-Eo. We'll now turn, in my next lectures, to yet another region of the world, crossing the Atlantic, to examine the origins of states and civilizations in the New World in North and South America. Thank you.